Access number 30629, Squad Anita Gordon Henderson, Reel 4. Now, what I'd like to do now is talk about the Spitfire, perhaps comparing it with the Hurricane.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
You were on the Spitfire 5B.
Yeah.
Could you give us a sort of quick guide, well, not quick, as much as you remember about the Spitfire?
Well, I suppose basically it was a shock to get in one to start with, having only flown Hurricanes, and then one of the squadron pilots was briefed to show me around the Spitfire cockpit, which I'd never seen before. So I sat in the thing for about 10 minutes and he pointed out the throttle and the pitch lever and the flaps and the undercart, how to pick up the undercart and so on, showed me what all the instruments were and where they were, and then said, well, get in it and go, just like that. So 10 minutes after looking at a Spitfire, I was then told to get off the ground.
And that was your first
time? That was the first time in 15 minutes, was it?
It was short, yeah, 45 minutes.
45 minutes. So I just flew around the area, getting used to the area, so that if I flew any distance away, I'd know how to get back.
Now, what was it like to fly? As much as
distinctly more powerful than the Hurricane on takeoff, much lighter. You had to be much more careful on takeoff to keep your rudders straight. Otherwise, it was very easy to swing off the runway. That was one of the faults of the Spitfire, was that the rudder was very, very sensitive. Not so bad on takeoff, but especially on landing. You had to make sure that you kept your rudders absolutely straight. Otherwise, you would go off the runway. And a lot of people did. And as I'll tell you later on, people who did always got a nasty scar on their forehead, which was known as the Petitfer scar, because you just went off the runway and clouted something. Yeah. Going back to the squadron, after that first flight, now, I think it was, what was the date of the first solo?
And then the 25th of March.
So my first op then, they're all numbered, the operations.
Oh, that was the April the 10th.
April the 10th.
Now, what did you think of the Spitfire yourself? I mean, did you like it?
Oh, better? Yes, very much so. Wasn't as sturdy as the Hurricane. It was more compact. It was a tighter cockpit. The instruments were all higgledy-piggledy in comparison to American aircraft, where everything is laid out in order. But the Hurricane and the Spitfire, they were dotted all over the place. You had to learn exactly where they were. It wasn't sort of laid out as a set plan, so that it was A to B. Your pressures were here, and your temperatures were here, and your altitude was here, and, you know, dotted all over the place. I mean, you got used to it, but in comparison to the Mustang flying that I did in OTU, the instruments were all over the place. But as far as the aeroplane, as far as flying it was concerned, it was beautiful.
Did they have any bad habits at all as an aeroplane?
Only on landing, if you weren't careful. I didn't find any bad habits with a Spit, no.
And the problem on landing was?
The problem on landing was that if you didn't keep your rudders absolutely straight, you were inclined to swing off the runway.
But if you knew that...
Then you had no problem.
And now, so...
We had rough old runways there, of course. They were grass runways and PSP, that metal runways that they laid down. But initially, it was just a grass airfield. At Super Chemist.
So that was just a grass field?
Yeah.
And they laid PSP later?
Later on.
What is PSP?
It's it's galvanized things, you know, with a lot of holes in. You lay it down and it's strips of metal, and it isn't solid in the middle. It's what's it like? It's like...
People will know, I think.
PSP, what it stood for, God knows.
Did that improve aggressive?
Well, it made it a runway. Other than that, I mean, you just knew that you got in your airplane here, and there's the end of the field, and you just aimed for it. But there wasn't a set runway as such.
Now you then
And it was pretty muddy and mucky too.
You start a series of training, you know, you had your first solo, then you do some air-to-ground firing, which is the first time you seem to have done any of that. Do you remember anything about that?
Did I?
Just a bit, yeah.
When? In 43?
March 25th, same day as your first thing, air-to-ground firing, it says.
Oh.
Don't remember it, yeah.
Don't remember it, we didn't.
And a bit of air combat training, but you don't remember that.
Well, only going up with another member of the squadron and flying around and learning how to be a number two. How to stay behind him slightly higher,
now
never lose sight of him,
business,
and the
can
weaving
you
behind him.
About all that? What were you meant to do as a number two?
Well, number one, his mission was to go, say, and check what there was in the way of opposition on the ground in a particular area. The ALO, the Army Liaison Officer, would brief us to start with and say, right, this is your area. And we want to find out what there is in this area. How much traffic is there? Is there any sign of a build-up of enemy units? Not necessarily photograph them. An ordinary TACAR was just looking at the ground to seeing what was there. So number one would do that. We'd usually fly out at about 7,000-8,000 feet. And when we got to the area, number one would say, right, going down. And he would go down to, say, 4,000 to 5,000 and go round his area, making notes as what he could see. Number two...
Proper notes, written notes.
Oh, yes. Or mark them on his map, whichever the pilot found it easiest. And as number two, you then stayed above him and kept him in sight and just weaved round his tail and kept an eye on what was going on around it else in the sky.
Now, the purpose of weaving, just explain what that was.
Well, weaving was really, if you just fly straight and level, you've only got one view, there, there, and there. Whereas if you're weaving, you can then look behind you, look up, and so on. And you just keep him in sight and make sure that nothing else happens.
So you were concentrating on, you weren't doing any reconnaissance?
No.
Entirely the number one.
Entirely. So, as I think I said, the number two never really knew exactly where he was. If anything had happened to number one, number two really would just have a vague idea, well, I knew that I was flying east to go to visit this area, so I'd better fly west to get back again. But you didn't really have an exact idea as to where you were. You knew vaguely where you were.
Now, we might as well talk about you. You did practice in weaving and the rest of it, but
yeah.
Your first mission's on the 10th of April, and it's a TACAR over
Mateur area. Yeah.
M-A-T-E-U-R area.
Yeah.
And it says there's a little flak.
Yeah.
That was a 50-minute wreck, and that was with Flying Officer Neil Wiley.
With Neil, yeah.
Now, do you remember that as your first mission? Do you
remember? Yes, I bloody well do. The interesting thing was that that morning, I knew I'd been briefed for my first mission, and my aircraft was ready, parachute on the seat, all ready for us to take off, and two bloody Messerschmitts came over, the only time that Sukhoi Kemis was raided, and shot the aircraft up. I had to change aeroplanes, get my parachute out, put it in another aeroplane, and then take off, which was pretty nasty to start with. Anyway, we took off and I followed Neil. Don't remember very much about the actual TACAR itself, except that I made absolutely sure I kept him in sight. And he did the mission, and back we came.
Do you remember the flak at all?
It was the first time there'd been flak, and it's just rather nasty because suddenly there's a black puff in the sky somewhere near you. And you know, they start firing at you really before you get, as you're flying along, they decide they'll fire at you. And you suddenly see a puff of black smoke here and there. And Neil, if I remember rightly, said, start weaving. And he and then you follow him and you change height to avoid the flak. That's your first sort of evasive tactic. because they presumably on the ground have worked out what your height is. And if you stay on it, and if you stay straight and level, they'll hit you. So you start changing height, weaving about the place to avoid the flak, and usually you're through it fairly rapidly.
And would he do a photograph on this one, or is a tacar?
No, that was a tacar, yeah.
Right, so that doesn't involve
photography. No photography on that one, yeah. Sorting out what's in the area.
And how nervous were you? I mean, you know, how did you feel in yourself about the mission?
Well, I was extremely nervous, of course, the first mission. I think I mainly just concentrated on keeping Neil in sight.
Do you think you showed it before the mission, that you were a bit...
I think you're bound to. I don't... Not to the extent that anyone would say, oh, come on, pull yourself together, or, you know, anything like that. It was excitement, really. It was your first mission. You're nervous, but you want to do it. You want to see what it's like. You want to find out what it's like.
Now, I presume you didn't see what was on the ground then?
No.
Yeah, because you'd have been neglecting your duty if you did.
Oh, yes.
So as far as you're concerned...
I was just following him. All I saw was the sky and hoped I wouldn't see anything else in it.
And you didn't?
No.
How did you feel after the mission?
Oh, absolutely exhilarated. Immediately came down, probably had a pint or two of beer, or I should think. Not that I recall, but I'm sure I was highly delighted. We then had to go and see the ALO and get debriefed. And I would just stand by while Neil told the ALO what he'd seen and marked it on the map.
How was this verbal? Can you tell us a bit about that?
He marked it on the map, yeah. Neil would have on the mission itself, he'd have known exactly where he was, of course, and he would have either have marked his map or he may have made notes. Pilots did, you did it differently, depending who you were.
So you wouldn't really have anything to report? So
no.
You'd just stand there with him. And it was just marked up, and it was to the intelligence officer, was that?
Yes.
And who was your intelligence officer?
Well, there was a major and a captain and two or three army fellas who were all part of the air liaison section, the ALOs. Jimmy Blythe was the major. Jimmy Hunt was the captain, and there were three, either they were army privates or corporals, or they were part of the army section, and they were permanently with the squadron.
And did you get on well with them? I mean,
yes.
Were they part of the team?
Very much so. Very much so, yes. We got on very well with all the army fellas.
And socialised with
them?
Yeah,
yes, indeed. They lived in the mess, you know. They were part of the squadron.
Now, that was your first mission on the 10th, and then after that, there's a range of missions. I mean, you go out
yes.
again on the 11th, that's in the Tabora area, and that says heavy flak.
Yes.
Well, now, I don't presume you can remember each mission now, years later.
No.
I mean, I don't know which range what you particularly remember.
Well, go to number 11 or 12, which is when I got shot down.
Is that the next big thing that happened?
Yes.
Then? Now, that was on the 28th of April, so it's only after, you know, 18 days, two or three weeks really
yeah.
later. Before that, you've done that's the 12th mission, you've done 11 missions before.
Yeah, always as number two.
Always as number two.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes you're under a bomber and fighter sweep, things like that.
Yes.
But there's nothing particularly to remember. They run in the fashion of the first.
Yes, that's right. And I would just be following Neil, going to different areas, and one or two of the missions he might have taken photographs, but I doubt it. I think they were all tactical.
They look all tacars.
Yeah.
They are all tacars.
We went to Bizerta, and we went to Mature, and we went to Beja, you know, all the little towns that I remember the names of in North Africa.
Now, so the next one, let's talk on April 28th, things go wrong for you.
Yeah.
your shop down. Now, what happened on the 28th? That's Attakar on the
Zagouan.
Zagouan area.
Spotting. Yeah, when the Germans were about to leave North Africa, they pulled everything back to the coast south of Tunis, and there's a range of mountains there called the Zagouan Mountains, and we were due to fly over there and spot the artillery, because of course the Germans had pulled everything back, their troops and their artillery, and they wanted to safeguard the evacuation from North Africa. So they had all their stuff there, lots of flak, and we flew over and I got hit.
By ground fire?
Yeah, by anti-aircraft fire, yeah.
And what do you remember? What happened when you were actually...
Well, there was a bloody great bang, a small hole in the wing, and all the temperatures started to rise. So I called up Neil and told him I'd been hit, and he came round and had a look at me and said, it doesn't look too bad, keep going. But as far as I was concerned, I had temperatures going through the roof, and I thought, well, I'll never get back from here, because it was quite a long... It was from Super Chemis to Zagouan was a fair distance, probably 30 minutes flying time.
So what happened? What did you decide to do?
So I decided to turn south, knowing that the 8th Army, Montgomery's mob, were coming up from the south, and find a field and force land, rather than jump out. I'd never had any parachute training, no, really, at all. And I wasn't at all enthusiastic about jumping out. So I flew south until I felt that I was over our own lines. Found a great big field, which looked nice and flat. Did a forced landing, wheels up, belly landing. And it went off very well. The field was quite smooth. And I just landed on my belly, slid along the ground, sat there petrified, while and looked around, absolutely nothing happening. So I got out, and I knew that I needed to be going south, because I knew that's where the front line was. And I went to a farmhouse, which was at the end of the field.
Did you stay near or by the aircraft?
Fairly near, yes. At the end of the field, there was the farmhouse. So I went to the farmhouse, which was deserted. This was around about early afternoon, if I remember rightly. Yes, it was. Early afternoon. Went into the farmhouse. Went up into the loft, I think it was, or the first floor, and sat there wondering what the hell to do. And I thought, it not knowing exactly where I was, I thought I'd better stay there for a while to see what happened and whether anyone would come along to see, to look at the aircraft. And after about an hour, a patrol of people came towards me from the north, from the way I'd landed. And I couldn't work out who the hell they were. I didn't recognise the uniforms. They went and looked around the aircraft. Then they started searching the immediate area. And there was I sitting in the roof with a 3.8 pistol like this, wondering who the hell they were. And they didn't come into the farmhouse. They must have decided, well, we don't know where the hell the pilot is, but he's obviously got away somewhere. And they disappeared.
Now, who were they, do you think?
Well, I think they were a German patrol. So I stayed where I was until dusk. There was no other movement anywhere. Didn't see anybody else. And at dusk, I decided that it was time to leave there and start walking south. I found a main road, or a road, and started walking down it. Pete?
Yes,
Dad. So I started walking down this road and it was getting dark. And of course I was pretty petrified, not knowing what the hell was going to happen. And suddenly a jeep came along and on the horn was doing the V for Victory sign. Da, 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 you know. And I leapt out of the Well, first of all, I leapt in the ditch when I heard the jeep coming. Then when it started giving the victory sign or noise, I then got back on the road. The jeep stopped, and it was French. The French 19 Corps picked me up.
Took me back. Free French unit?
Well, free French, I suppose, yes. Yeah. Took me back to their base, which was not very far away, and it transpired that I had landed in no man's land. If I'd walked the other way, I'd have run into the German lines. So it was fortunate that I went south. They took me back, filled me up with brandy, debriefed me, and they had an ALO, and the ALO, quite by chance, happened to be an ALO who had been on 225 Squadron. Ian Gompertz was his name, Major. So he debriefed me, asked me what I'd done and what I'd done with the aircraft and how I'd landed and so on. And I stayed there overnight, and then they ran me back to the squadron. I got back to the squadron 48 hours later to find that the boys had, you know, half my kit was missing, which they'd taken to themselves, got that all back, and that was that.
Did you have any
And I wasn't I wasn't injured, no.
Didn't affect you at all, really?
No, not at all. I got away with it.
And that's how you
I
felt?
I mean, it was a field which was pretty flat. I circled round and saw this big field which looked pretty flat and thought, right, that'll do.
Now, so that was quite near the end, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, very much so.
Because that was the 12th mission. That was on the 20th.
Yeah, 28th. And the campaign ended in May, didn't it?
So, yes, it did.
Yeah.
You carry on doing missions, though, and there's one that intense light flak. It doesn't make sense, but I know what you mean. It's a light anti-aircraft fire, quite intense.
Oh, yes. Once I got back to the squadron, I mean, I went back into, you know, routine flying.
Now, there's one where you go on a photographic sortie with Merton. Did they differ in any particular way?
What, the missions themselves?
Yes.
Yes, because the number one would then have to fly straight and level for a given period of time while he was taking the photograph.
So
I would know. He would then say to me, right, I'm going down a bit lower to take the photographs, and he would fly, he'd photograph whatever it was he'd been asked to do. But I think at Bizerta we did a photographic mission, didn't we? Or did I say where it was? That's my writing.
It says Merton. I thought that might be the pilot you were weaving for, but
no, I think I was with Neil all the time. I didn't fly with anybody else.
So it's my read. It's Mature. Yes. MATURE.
That's right. Yeah.
Now, so what happened when the war basically finished?
That finished then. Yeah.
What
Well, we sat around a bit and did nothing very much.
Now, what was mess life like out there?
Oh, it was it was tented. Although there was a big building at the end of the runway, which, no, that's right, it wasn't tented. At Sukhul Kemis, we were in this big house, which had been a monastery. And there were monks up the end, all around the place.
And was it called you were in the old cells or rooms then?
Yes, I suppose.
And how comfortable was it?
Oh, very. Yes, it was all right. Yeah.
Now, what was mess life like? It's your first experience of a real school.
Yeah, mess life was good. Yeah, we were very well fed, I have to say, in comparison to the rations that people were having in this country. There were always local food. The local farmers provided eggs and milk and stuff like that. Yeah, and then the rations would come up. No, but we didn't do badly at all for food.
And what about drinking in the mess? What sort of
drinking in the mess? It was local wine from the monastery, most of it.
Good stuff. We used to wine.
Yes. Well, no, not at all in those days. No, a great deal of vermouth, if I remember rightly. There was always vermouth around the place, which I've never drank from that day to this. But vermouth seemed to be the most popular drink. It was either that or wine. Neil Wiley was a wine buff. He was an expert on wine. He was much older than anybody else on the squadron. That's why he was known as Dad Wiley.
Was it a hard drinking squadron? You know, there's myths about drinking.
Yes.
And some squadrons do drink quite a bit. And yes. Some don't. And some are in between.
Well, we were in between. There was no way you could really get tight every night because you never really knew what your mission would be the next day. You usually, in the evening of Monday, you'd be told when you were flying the next day, whether you were going out at dawn or whether you were going out in the afternoon. The dawn patrols, we would sit in the aircraft at the end of the runway while it was still dark. And then as soon as it was light enough to see the end of the runway, you take off. So by the time you were over the German lines, they would be having breakfast. And they'd be having fun. Yeah, it was one way to spot where they were, because they'd be getting up and having their own breakfasts, and there'd be lots of activity about the place, so you could then see where the hell they were. And that was the dawn patrols, they were.
Well, the TACARs. But
they were TACARs, yeah.
But they took place at dawn, whatever.
Yeah, that was. Yeah. And yes, the first sortie was always very early. And you didn't always get the first sortie, of course. It was you took your turn.
Now, did you have a servant at Suchokemis?
Not in Suchokemis, no.
And what about going out for an evening? Was there anywhere to go?
No.
For a bash or a...
No, no. When you weren't flying, if you had a day off, you'd probably get in a jeep and go up to the local coast or Bone or somewhere and just have a day off. A flight would fly one day and B flight the next.
So it's just...
Usually you had a day on, day off.
And on your day off you'd go to the beach, is it? You mean?
Well, yes. Either that or you'd just swan around the local countryside and find a pub, a taverna or whatever.
Now,
But there wasn't much. In North Africa, there wasn't very much to do. It was a pretty desolate country.
So you were there, and then what happens next then? So the end of the campaign, you know, as far as you're concerned...
Yes, was May. We saw the German army surrendering, in great columns of them all coming towards us, and they were all of course, going off to America or Canada,
what was the mood like? I mean,
They were just shuffling along. They weren't particularly... they didn't seem to be particularly unhappy, but they weren't particularly happy, of course. But they were just doing what they were told. There were plenty. It was the whole army. It was von Arnim's army.
And
I don't know how many there were, but there were several thousand in the German army that all went to Canada as prisoners.
And what did you do next then? I mean, did you stay at Suchokemis?
We did for a while, and then we moved up to Hammamet, or at least Bouffricha was the next station.
Hang on, so that's...
You'll see that at the end of the... when did we move?
Oh, Ariana to Bouffricha.
Bouffricha, yep.
Oh, yeah, about a week later. Now, you moved to Bouffricha, which is spelled Bouffica.
Yep.
Just
south of Hammamet.
On the...
south of Tunis.
And that's on the 10th of June, you go
10th
there.
Of June. So we were taken out of ops then. So the squadron was on a rest period.
And what was the Bouffricha airfield like?
Well, very small and pretty rough. It wasn't a runway. Again, it was just a grass field.
And
we just then went in for a period of training, you know, practicing. We did some air-to-air firing there, I remember.
Now, what was that? What was that like, air-to-air?
Well... again, at that stage, the squadron picked up a Hurricane, and the Hurricane was used to tow the drogue. And then a Spitfire, somebody would fly the Hurricane, and then a Spitfire would come along and fire on the drogue, and we all took turns at firing. And then, of course, when the drogue landed, you could then see how many holes there were in the drogue and how many times you'd hit the damn thing. It was towed behind the Hurricane, fortunately quite a long way behind it.